Welcome to the D Word, the UK's only weekly internet radio show that talks dementia, with me, your host, Peter Hill. Glad to have you come here on the D Word. Now, whatever you say about the internet, it's a great way to meet interesting people. And that's how I found this week's guest, Neil Olingshig. Neil is a registered dementia nurse and founder of evidence-based training company R. Glenn Training, and he's passionate about supporting people with learning disabilities who develop dementia. Neil will be joining me right after this from the Jayhawks. Forgive me a little bit of self-indulgence by playing something from one of my favourite bands, the Jayhawks, and it'll be all right tonight. My guest this week is Neil Olingshig. Neil, welcome to the D Word. Great to have you with me here on the show. We'll be talking a little bit about learning disabilities and dementia, but before we get to that, give us a little bit of history. I mean, how did you become involved in working in the dementia area?
Well, how far back do I go? I started off as a marine biologist, which nowadays kind of helps me with analysing a lot of the data. I can read a scientific paper and get into the research quite well. I then did a master's in broadcasting and worked in wildlife documentaries. Ended up realising that the media industry had sharks in it that I hadn't really studied about in marine biology, and that maybe wasn't for me. So I did some. I went into healthcare originally just to pay the rent, to be honest. It was kind of a necessity, and then I realised I just loved it. So I think it was my mum said one day, "Have you ever thought of being a nurse?" So trained as a mental health nurse because I love. Philosophy, psychology, and everything else, and it kind of brought a lot of those interests together. Didn't really feel like working in the psychiatric world. Working in psychiatric wards, I was coming across people who I could see the world had been very harsh to, and I didn't feel like I wanted to be the one that was suddenly having to sedate them because of that. I felt dementia had something more real to it in a way. Not that the experience of people with mental health problems isn't real, but there's a progressive illness there. There was something tangible, and also what it meant is that I could build those long-term relationships with people. A lot of times, as a nurse in the mental health system, you're kind of firefighting. You're seeing people come through who are in crisis, but you don't really get to have that long-term building of relationship. And that's why I really loved about dementia care was, as a care home nurse and then as a care home lead nurse. I was able to have those long-term relationships with my residents, with their families, and I felt ethically and values-wise that was something that really sat a lot better with me.
Well, sharks in the media industry, there's a discussion for us to have on another day. So let's look at learning disabilities and dementia. I mean, tell us a little bit about the story with learning disabilities and dementia, a few statistics, and introduce it a bit to us.
Yeah, so when I decided to go into training and I left clinical pr practice, I decided to look at because I had this dual interest in dementia and learning disabilities because I had a background in doing learning disabilities work as well. And I realized just how little there is. Now, what really struck me, Pete, was there is what they call the hidden majority in this country where they reckon up to 75% of learning disabilities, people with learning disabilities living in the community, are neither on their GP's disability register or known to social services. They're essentially ghosts in the system. Often these people are being cared for at home, and more often they're not. So I looked at the figures. We're looking at maybe upwards of 400,000 of these are now over 50, and therefore at high risk of developing dementia. Oftentimes, you can imagine that these people are being cared for by parents who are themselves elderly and will have their own care needs and their own care burden. We're even seeing more and more people with learning disabilities caring for a parent with dementia. Now, you can see how, unfortunately, a lot of these people will have brought up their child with learning disability by themselves. Quite understandably, they've got a reticence to engage with services because we know the treatment that people with learning disabilities several decades ago when these people were children was quite bad, to put it very mildly. So you can see that a lot of these people are quite reticent to approach services. And so I was suddenly in a situation where I was thinking, wait a minute, all these people out there that we don't even know of are going to develop dementia. And those parents are going to cope as best they can, within their abilities. But at what stage are we going to get catastrophic breakdown of care within the home? And at what stage do we get a tsunami of people showing up on the doors of mental health services, learning disability services, care homes, etc., already in a place of crisis? So that's where I was coming from. I was when I suddenly was awoken to that statistic and that situation, I was like, I have to do something about this. I have to use the skills that I have to try and address this problem because A, I care. There are people I love with learning disabilities, and I do not want the world that we have right now for them. And I want them to grow old in a world that will be ready for them if they ever develop dementia. So that's what's driving me every day, really.
Yeah, that's where you're coming from. My uncle had learning disabilities, so I've got a little bit of stake in the game there. Now, when it comes to diagnosis for dementia, a lot of people have a lot of trouble. It's been a big thing that we've talked about on the show, how long it takes. If you are living with a learning disability, then it obviously is going to add to the difficulty, I guess, of getting a diagnosis.
Yeah, and I mean, what's been interesting in a lot of the work that I've done through my training company and through the tools that I've created, because do you remember I was saying I'm an academic to start with, so there's plenty of great research about diagnostics in people learning disabilities and dementia. Whether that research has been applied in everyday tools that people can use on the ground, that hadn't really happened, and that's where maybe my strength was in my master's in communication and my knowledge of nursing, is that I'm able to synthesize a lot of the research and create practical tools through Araglen training, through my training business. Sorry for the plug there. But and so one of the things that I wanted to address was the fact that actually dementia looks quite different in people with learning disabilities. So it's often missed, it's often attributed to other factors. And so basically, training and like care and proper interventions are often delayed. And as we know, with learning disabilities, dementia can progress a lot quicker. So the longer we leave it before we get a diagnosis, the quicker that deterioration can be. So that's why I create the baseline framework, which is a list of words like B is for behavior change, for example, because that's one of the first signs before memory or cognitive issues. Behavior changes can be a big sign. The A is for appetite and weight change. And so it's basically a list, and it could be the kind of little aide-mémoire that someone could have up on a wall in a handover room, just to keep those kind of signs and symptoms, like, at the fore, for people to look out for. And it's a free resource that is freely, available on my website, that people can download and use as much as they like. Because for me, the important thing is as many people have those in their hands, the quicker people might out there might actually get diagnosed. The big thing, and I think like with other things, it's going to be the risk of diagnostic overshadowing, because you can see that someone might, yes, they might have behavior changes, but that might be due to pain. It might be due to mental health issues. We know that people with Down syndrome can be more prone to anxiety, depression. So when was the last time we looked at their medication? Have they had a recent event? Has a carer left the setting? Those type of things. So, I've also created checklists that can then be used to try and eliminate other factors. But I appreciate what you're saying. It can be quite a minefield, and there's a lot of work in A, recognizing those symptoms because they are quite different, but also making sure that they're not actually, there's no other root causes to those symptoms.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And I guess one of the things is consistency. You have to know the person. If I use my uncle's example, he knew every football ground in England. And if you said, mm-hmm. you know, where do Chelsea play, say Stamford Bridge or whatever, if one day I went in and I said, where do Chelsea play, and he didn't know, then I would think, oh, something going wrong here. But that's because I know him.
Yeah. And I think that's why I create like the system I call is called baseline, because I think having that solid baseline. And so NICE guidelines say that people with Down syndrome should have a baseline assessment made as early as age 30. Now, the reason for that is because people with Down syndrome are a lot more likely to develop Alzheimer's. The probability in that population of developing Alzheimer's by the age of 60 is up to 75%. The reason for that is quite specific. So we know that Alzheimer's is caused by amyloid plaques. It's one of the causative factors. Amyloid precursor protein is one of the proteins that the body then creates plaque out of. It turns out that the gene that codes for amyloid precursor protein is on chromosome 21. And the one thing that causes Down syndrome is having three copies of chromosome 21 rather than two copies. So basically, at any time and any point in their life, someone with Down syndrome will have higher levels of amyloid precursor protein than the general public. And so they will be a lot more prone to those proteins then accumulating and becoming plaques. So they are genetically predisposed to develop Alzheimer's a lot earlier. And so that's why having that baseline at age 30 is important, because it's about, like you said, it's about noticing the changes, having regular reviews and having a solid baseline that we can base that review on, and noticing that acquired change is all important.
And I guess one of the other areas is you go and see a GP. You're lucky if you see the same one twice. If you go to a hospital, you're seeing a doctor you don't know. If you're under care of social services, you might have a different social worker or a carer. All those things must play a part.
Yeah, and that's the thing. This is why my big project and what I'm working towards is creating an online platform where I can have if you go back to even before having dementia, having a brain health plan. How many people at age 30, when they do become at risk of developing dementia, have a solid brain health plan where they can be educated and encouraged to develop good habits that might reduce that risk down the line. And then having that assessment, having those reviews, having all those things. And the idea for me would be to create a platform that people like organizations or carers or families could go on to, put all that information in, and then just print a report out that they could then go and say, look, this has changed, this has changed, this has changed. And so I'm not there to say that anything I've created are diagnostic tools, but if they can support families to say, to go to the people who will eventually give someone a diagnosis and say, this is what they were like 2 years ago, this is how they're presenting now, this is what's changed, in a structured manner, then hopefully that can then help carers really communicate that and consistently communicate that wherever that person goes, you know? So that's the big plan anyway. I'm still working on it. I'm no IT genius. So the idea of creating an online platform is still a bit daunting, but I'm getting help with that. So,
yeah, I think, it's a very, very solid idea. I mean, there are some. I looked up some NICE guidelines this morning before talking to you, and it's NICE guidelines actually say that care should be more coordinated amongst organisations, primary, secondary, social services. So there's kind of the basis there, but I guess is this a bit of a niche area that, there's loads of guidelines, and these are the ones that kind of get left in the corner.
Yeah, Yeah, and unfortunately, guidelines are great, but if nobody's actually using them, they are but a piece of paper. And like you said, the NICE guidelines are very clear. There have been published national guidelines by the British Psychological Society, a team headed by Karen Dodd, a wonderful researcher and great proponent for people with learning disabilities and dementia. So there are solid guidelines. I've been over the past few months approaching different ICBs throughout the country just to see what their post-diagnostic pathways were in terms of dual diagnosis, what care there was in place. Because what we often get, Pete, is that in a lot of ICBs, you will have dementia commission services and you'll have LD commission services, and in the middle is this massive gap. Okay, and so you might have someone who's known to LD serve, like LD, they mightn't be known to nobody. They go to their GP, the GP says, "We think you've got dementia, go to dementia services." Dementia services will say, "Sorry, we're not an LD service, go off to LD." LD will go, "Sorry, we've never heard of anybody with dementia." And so it's very, very patchy. Some real great centres of excellence. So Karen Dodd herself was based in the Black Country in that region. And so they are leading the way in terms of pathways for post-diagnostic care. They've got psychologists, nurses, oh, you name it, they have it. It's wonderful. And they're following the guidelines to the book. They're probably, you are Salford are again very good, really great team there. There's a few others, but again, it's difficult actually finding those. There's a lot of great work going on, but it's very patchy and they're not often talking to each other. So I've met clinical psychologists doing their best to create a pathway, and I'm like, let's not reinvent the wheel. How about I put you in touch with the guys in the Black Country who can then support you? But unfortunately, you know, the way the NHS works and having individual ICBs, you often get pockets of really excellent work, but it's not being disseminated, and other people are trying to replicate that work with very little support when it's actually being done only a couple of hundred miles away. So part of the job that I'm doing and part of the thing that I'm doing is you know, I've created the very first Facebook group about dementia and learning disabilities. There wasn't one. Can you imagine that, Pete? The whole of Facebook, there was not a single Facebook group about learning disabilities and dementia. I was a bit shocked. So I started one. Same thing with LinkedIn. The idea is to really bring the researchers, the clinicians, people with lived experience, trainers, etc. Get everybody in one room so they can network and they can share best practice so we can bring this field forward, because I think at the moment we're a band of very valiant people who really want the best for the populations that we work for. But I think we could do better in working together and pooling our resources. So that's perhaps my call out on this program. If there's anybody listening who works with learning disabilities and dementia, to get in touch and we can join forces and push forward best practice, because there's some really good practice out there, and you know there's the, and those who have best practice are more than happy to support others who want to develop it. You know, I found that it's a very supportive community. There's not that many of us, and when we do meet, we get very excited about meeting each other, and we're also very, very supportive of each other in developing the practice.
Getting at my Loretta Lynch, I've been feeling a little lonesome, and I know when I hear you sing, it's gonna be alright. Drop that needle, let her spin, take me on back to when I swear that second hand went a little slower and then ran. And those old country songs still ring true. They pick me up every time I'm feeling blue. You hear a worried gal singing a worried song. I'm worried now, but I won't be worried long. Yes, I'm worried now, but I won't be worried long. Thank you. off all the people and places yesterday. I hear that lonesome whippoorwill sound, just like I feel as I watch the autumn leaves all falling from the trees. And those old country songs still ring true. They pick me up every time I'm feeling blue. You hear a worried gal singing a worried song. I'm worried now, but I won't be worried long.
They are the Wonder Women of Country and Won't Be Worried Long. The UK Health Radio Awards 2026 are coming up. And once again, there's the Wendy Mitchell Dementia Support category, with five nominees who will be announced shortly. And the voting for the awards will start on the 5th of October. Back to this week's guest now, Neil Olingshig.
Yeah, I don't, well, you've got another member for the LinkedIn group, because I've joined that. Which,
I
just think it's a great way, and I think you're echoing a lot of things I hear in the fact that you've got people doing things that don't know about other people doing things which are very close, and you just really need that consistent approach of knowing what everybody does. An example I had, you know, go back to my uncle, the example I had from my uncle is he went into residential care when he was 64, and at the time he was being covered by the residential care group that went up to retirement age. So they said, well, we'll deal with, you know, looking at where he's going to go. And I said, well, actually, he's going to spend the majority of his life over 65. So wouldn't it be a good idea if the 65 plus group actually had a look? And I got, no, I'm sorry, we can't do that. And I was just thinking, this is crazy. You know, we all need to go all the way together.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things you put your finger on is that kind of is that transition, especially post-diagnosis with someone. So you might have someone with a learning disability and they've lived in a, let's say, a supported living environment. Quite a standard way would be two or three people living together in a suburban semi-detached with maybe one carer coming in few times a day to accompany people out, or, you know, if there's higher needs, they might stay overnight. We don't know. But, you know, that type of thing. Now, someone might live there for 20 years. They might know the people in the house for nearly as long as that. They might know some of the carers for as long as that. Now, if they suddenly develop dementia, you know, this is a dementia, this is an LD service, it's not a dementia service. So do they understand that perhaps in 2 or 3 years that person won't be able to walk? So have we got wheelchair access? Is their bedroom big enough for a hospital bed? Is there a hoist in the bathroom? You know, is there even a room for overnight care if they need personal care during the night? Is there enough resources for a double up care? Is there a local hospice that if they want to, you know, so one of the things that the number one thing that care providers in the LD space report as a barrier to effective dementia care is accommodation suitability. Because as I've just given you the example, a semi-detached, you know, home in the suburbs might be fine for someone who's quite independent, but is completely unsuitable to care for someone with dementia as that dementia advances. So it's one of the, again, it's me applying the research and creating a tool. I created a suitability tool where it takes basically those providers through every step that is going to be necessary of those needs that that person will have, and is then gives them a RAG rating to basically let them know, is the house suitable as it is for now? Does it need adaptation? Or even with adaptation, this house will never be suitable eventually. So do we need to look at transfer? Because unfortunately, what we're seeing is by the time transfer is being considered, it's sometimes too late. I was speaking to a lady the other day, because it was so late by the time her daughter had been transferred from a supported living. It took them 70, 70 care homes before they found somewhere across the country who would actually take her. Now, the irony is, one of the components that meant that her transfer was delayed is because the staff loved her so much that they didn't want to let her go, and they wanted to fight to keep her there, which is admirable. And you know, it touches on one of the things, that one of the differences in the philosophy and what I'm coming across in my training on a very fundamental philosophical sense, is that people in the learning disability space have spent their entire life pr promoting someone's independence, okay? Promoting their autonomy, doing everything in terms of positive risk taking. Now, of course, he can go to the shop on his own. We've worked for years for him to get to the point where he can go to the shops on his own. And now I'm coming along and saying, but he's got dementia, he's not going to find his way home. And you can see that actually managing someone's deterioration goes counter to their entire philosophy in terms of promoting someone's independence. And I feel like on a very fundamental level, that's where there's a big work for me to do in my training, is how I can teach carers to navigate that boundary between promoting independence and ma managing deterioration. And I think that's a fascinating, you know, for me as on an intellectual level, it's a fascinating thing to kind of juxtapose, really.
Yeah, that's a really interesting one. I mean, when it comes to carers, we had the new Prime Minister saying that carers should receive dementia training because a large percentage of them haven't. Obviously, you can be on that because you're looking at LD and dementia training. I mean,
Yeah.
that's a big task.
I think what's interesting, Pete, is that when I was first asked, when I was just doing generic dementia training, and someone said, "Hey, could you deliver this training for this group of staff? By the way, they're LD carers." And I went, "That's not a tweak. That's a different course." Because interestingly enough, and this is what I discovered, it's like, well, they'll know a lot about managing behaviors, they'll know a lot about non-verbal communication, they might even know everything they need to know about supporting someone with eating dysphagia. So there are a lot of practical skills that people with an LD carer's background will already know. But ironically, the flip side of that is that when I was doing the dementia awareness part, I was teaching Dementia 101. It's not like just because someone teaches LD means that they know anything more about dementia than the next person down the street. So saying, you know, stuff like, oh, you know, when someone says I want to go home, they don't really mean like home. What they're really expressing is a need for comfort. And they're like, oh, wow, that's really interesting. And I'm like, oh, wow, okay, so you don't actually understand dementia at all. So the irony is that on one side they know lots, but on the other side, the dementia training I'm doing is actually very simple dementia training. There's nothing complex to it. It's very much how do you meet the person in the moment? How do you know, read between the lines? How do you create connection? All those kind of little things that you would teach as a dementia foundations course is what I cover with them, because why would we assume that they understand more about dementia than anybody else? You know, so that's where
Yeah.
it was an interesting insight that I had there when I entered that world.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Got that sad feeling from a broken heart, and feeling so close to the end. Let me love you tonight. There's a million stars in the sky. Let me love you tonight. I'll make everything alright when you find out how good love can be. You're so lost when it sets you free. They say once in your life you find someone that's right, someone who loves you like me. Let me love you tonight. There's a million stars in the sky. Let me love you. I'll make everything alright when the moon has forgotten what the night's about, and the stars can't work their places out. Hold me tighter than tight. When the daylight comes, it'll be alright.
That for a while. Pure Berry League and Let Me Love You Tonight. This week we're talking dementia and learning disabilities with my guest Neil Olingshig.
Yeah, it's kind of having the skill set but needing to have the knowledge put onto it. And kind of then presumably they sat there and went, oh, wait a minute, I can do that, and there's things in this new area that I might be good at. And it's kind of enlightening, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think what's great is that, you know, this is a self-selected group of people who've wanted to work in LD. So they've got a certain level of compassion, of empathy, of wanting the best for people they care for. So I've already got a solid values base to work on. And then it's just literally just tweaking their mindsets in terms of, you know, avoiding correcting people, going with the flow, all those little tricks that help, you know, manage someone's sense of self, their identity. There's also what's interesting in terms of, you know, you've got to learn how to, for example, what do you tell other people, like someone's friends? So someone else might live in a house, or they might have a community of people with learning disabilities. How do you explain dementia to them? Because they need to be accompanied on that journey, because they need to understand why their friend is changing, or why their behaviours might have changed. You know, there's a whole field of research by someone called Irene Tufnyvine, who's an amazing woman who's done a lot of work on breaking bad news. How do you introduce someone to the fact that they now have a diagnosis of dementia? They have a human right to know what they have. It shouldn't be held from them. But yet we often move away from having difficult conversation with people with learning disabilities because we feel they might not understand or they might get upset. I mean, who doesn't get upset if they get a diagnosis of something that's life limiting? It's by getting upset that we move beyond. And yet people aren't afforded the right to have that discussion. And so there's a lot of work in how you accompany someone. So that's where a lot of the training I do around dementia and learning disabilities is how we communicate that diagnosis and how we communicate to the people around that person so that they can be, you know, accompanied properly. So one of the forms that I have is called My Baseline Story, where it's really spoken in the first person and it's asking someone, you know, what do they call it? They might call it dementia. They might call it my fuzzy brain. Or so all carers need to use my fuzzy brain from then on, because that's how it makes sense to that person. You know, who do they want to know? How they'd like to be supported? All those type, even funeral plans. You'll find you go to a funeral of someone who's passed away with learning disabilities and you'll know whether they've taken part in that funeral or not, because you'll find that the ones where they've prepared it, there's lots of great music, there's lots of images and colour, and you can see there's been an effort. While someone where they were never asked, it's very generic and very sad in a way. So, and a lot of people with learning disabilities sometimes have a very much more pragmatic and level-headed view of death or things that, you know, the general public might find upsetting. They're quite happy to talk about quite openly. So we need to get over ourselves and have those discussions with people.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's something that I've come across numerous times on the show in having those discussions with people living with dementia. And it's all about person-centred care and knowing the person, isn't it? But I want to go back to one thing that you introduced earlier on in the conversation that I had never thought of. And I'm sure, a few listeners are in the same boat here, in the fact you said that we could have people with learning disabilities now looking after their parents who are now living with dementia. And in terms of, you know, interpretation and letting them know what's going on, that has got to be a real task.
Yeah. And there's a lot of work, especially in University of Stirling is one of the poles in terms of research, and lots of there's some great talks around how do we support someone with learning disabilities make sense of their parent. It could be someone with autism. You know, it's hard enough for someone to go to a GP appointment when it's for themselves, let alone if they're then accompanying a parent and the information is then, you know, and there's nobody else. And so the GP is now speaking to one person who's got a learning disability and another person who's got, you know, advancing cognitive decline. You know, how do we support? And it's sad to say there's very little out there, Pete. It's really sad to say, but there are no pathways. You know, it's something that's so new. We're looking at the first generations, really, of people who are growing older with learning disabilities in significant numbers. So we're looking at very much an emerging situation. And I think in a lot of places, you know, the services are just not there to support people. You know, how is someone with a learning disability going to be supported, for example, to go and get their parents' medication because their parent now can't leave the house? How even finding a care home, you know, how, you know, someone needs to step in and support them in doing that. And, you know, how long people are left without that support. You'd be surprised just how little support there is out there. And unless the family rallies around, you'll find there's very little in the way of help.
This is really fascinating stuff, Neil. And I kind of get the feeling that we're on the launch pad here of, this kind of taking off as a subject. We're running out of time a bit. I will definitely get you back on the show to talk about a little bit about how things are going. And, just a little teaser for that. If we're talking in a year's time, what's the one thing you hope will have been achieved in this area?
I think one thing that we'll all share is the introduction of and I hope our Prime Minister will go through with his promises in making dementia awareness training part of mandatory training in all settings. And I say that not just for my population in terms of learning disabilities, but across the country. There is too much suffering going on out there, and I don't mean just suffering of patients, suffering of staff who just with a little training could avoid so much more. Of the distress that they're encountering. So that would be one thing. And I think ideally in a rosy world that will, I'm probably pushing it too far, all ICBs having an effective post-diagnostic pathway for people with learning disabilities and dementia. I want dementia services and learning disability services to talk to each other, to sit in a room and say, can we at least have one person from each side get in a little group and we can talk about how we can work together to support these groups? Because right now we're way too siloed. And if we could bring services together and have some kind of pathway, I think that would be wonderful.
Well, so do I. Thank you so much. It's been really excellent. And I hope if just, one listener out there has learned something and goes on to change the situation, then we've done our job a little bit on the D word here. But, thanks for your passion. Thanks for your knowledge. Thanks for being my guest. And we will definitely talk again in the future.
Thank you very much, Pete.
Thanks to Neil for raising some great points and his passion in supporting people with learning disabilities. That's all we got time for. Thanks to Angela, my production assistant. Next week, my guest is Angela Fairhurst, who, while supporting her mother through Lewy body dementia, started to produce Jerry gadgets in her kitchen, unaware at the time it would turn into a worldwide company. So until then, thanks for your company and take care now.